You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Hi everyone, Paul here, and just a quick message from me to let you know that if you are looking to improve the performance of your team, no matter whether it is a work, sporting or community one, then we've developed some tools to help. On the website, you will find our Thriving Teams Diagnostic, which uses insights from the more than 200 great coaches we have interviewed to challenge you with a series of questions to help you understand how your team is performing. It's free and only takes a few minutes to complete. If you'd like to know more, you can check out our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast. On this podcast, we continue our exploration of thriving teams with the great coach, Kevin Eastman. Kevin is an American basketball coach. He started coaching in 1978, progressing through assistant roles to become the head coach of Belmont Abbey College. He then went on to lead Washington State University and then the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. In 2003, he was Nike's basketball director of skills, and through that role met Doc Rivers, who invited him to become an assistant with the Boston Celtics. That team went on to win the 2008 NBA championship. These days, Kevin is an in-demand public speaker and the author of the terrific book, Why the Best Are the Best, 25 powerful words that impact, inspire, and define champions. And just before we go to the interview, today's podcast is brought to you by the Macquarie University Business School's MBA program. Designed to empower, challenge, and transform, the Macquarie MBA gives you the business skills and knowledge you need to succeed in an evolving global economy. The program bridges the gap between theory and real-world application, bringing together world-leading professors, executives, and industry partners to teach you how business can be used for good. I have just started working with the team at Macquarie on some projects and can attest to the quality of the people and material. To find out more, search for Macquarie University Business School's MBA. And now, please enjoy our interview with Kevin Eastman.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Well, Kevin Eastman, good morning, hello, and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate you having me on, and hate that it might be the early part of the day for you guys. It's the afternoon for us. So I'm ready to go.
Right. Thank you.
Paul's always working. So
that, of course, is the voice of my co-host, Professor Eric Knight. Eric, how are you?
I'm well, Paul. I was just saying you're always working. So it's always a good time to do an interview.
Thank you very much. That is true. I am always working, if only it is on my golf game. But Kevin, could we start with something really simple? Could you tell us where you are in the world and what you've been up to so far today?
Yeah, well, currently I'm sitting in my home office in Richmond, Virginia, and this is where my wife, Wendy, and I chose to live after I got out of the NBA, which is for those who maybe don't follow the professional basketball league over here. So I've been out for about, maybe 8 years now. And when I left there, I knew what I was going to get into, and that was kind of into the world of speaking, both with sports teams and with corporate teams. So the last 7 years, 8 years, whatever it's been, that's what I've been doing and enjoying it, and also enjoying opportunities to listen to and learn from other people, which is kind of the platform that you have created here for a lot of people over there, maybe around the world, probably.
Thanks, Kevin. In fact, I was brought to your attention through one of the coach developers here at the Australian Institute of Sport, who recommended that I connect with you because of your LinkedIn profile and the great social media presence that you have. So very much looking forward to talking with you today about all things teams and basketball and perhaps more generally just leadership. But Kevin, can we start with the book? I read it over the summer break, over the Christmas break. It's called Why the Best of the Best, 25 Powerful Words That Impact, Inspire and Define Champions. So firstly, congratulations. It's an excellent read, I think, particularly for anyone that wants to improve their own self-leadership. And you know, one of the ideas in the book that resonated with me very strongly was this one where you say, be there before you get there. And I wanted to ask you, firstly, can you tell us how you've applied this concept in your own life?
Oh, so we're jumping in right away. Okay, so be there before you get there really is my definition for preparation. And I guess maybe if you have a lot of people who enjoy leadership, they'll know the name Stephen Covey. And he mentions many times about, you know, start with the end in mind. And that truly what it is. You know, I want to be somewhere, even as simple as a speaking engagement. I actually want to get up onto the stage. And in particular, quite frankly, it's two things I look at. How wide is the audience I'm speaking to? Literally, how wide? Because I might want to have to walk from one side of the stage to the other so I can have connection with both sides and the entire audience. But the most important thing, and this may sound silly, but you guys both have probably spoken in front of groups, and you do not want this to happen. I want to know where all the cords are, all the wires are. There's nothing worse than being introduced and they think you're God's gift to the subject that you've been given to speak on. And 5 minutes into the talk, you go down, right? And you trip over a wire. So as silly as that sounds, I'll always know where everything is. And then another thing is, I was on a speaking engagement and there was another speaker prior to me, and something went wrong with the PowerPoint that he had. And you could tell it shook him up and almost got him to the point of a little angry, like, you know, you brought me in here and this is a beautiful hotel and why is this happening? Right. Well, I already know what I'm going to do. I ever since I've been doing this, right, I already know what I'm going to do if that happens. Right. So I want to be there before I get there. So really, whatever it is, whatever task we have, whatever goal we have, whatever we want to try and accomplish, we should know, like, what does that end look like, or at least have a feel of that, and then build backwards, right? I want to make sure that once I get to that end, I've done everything possible to make sure that end actually looks like what I thought it would look like when I started. So that's for me, really, what it's all about. And then I guess the last thing I'd say with that, and in particular the word preparation, because that's the definition, be there before you get there, is preparing for something is the, I believe, ultimate form of respect for whatever it is, the people you're speaking to, the tasks that you have in front of you. You put the time in to make sure that you have put yourself in a position to be the very best at whatever it is you've been asked to do or whoever it is you've been asked to speak to. So that's kind of probably a long answer to a short question.
No, and it's a great answer. And I think as we go through this interview today and we get into your story, this idea of respect coming before the opportunities are presented to you will come through quite strongly. But if I could just build on this idea of words a little bit more, Kevin, because again, in the opening of the book, you have this great quote. You say, "I became convinced that success comes down to the words people live by, the concepts they execute, and the understanding of the context around both." And so if I just step back a little bit more and take this high level, what do you think are the most important words teams could use to focus their energies?
Yeah, well, and I'm not here to sell books by any means, but allow me to just reference the book because it will help me answer this question. But really, the book was written for, it's a burning desire I had to find out, like, why do some people make it and some don't? When I was a little boy and I fell in love with basketball, I had pictures on my wall and the back of my door of the professional players over here. And I always used to think, why did that guy make it, but a whole bunch of players play and they didn't make it, right? So I was on almost a 35-year to 40-year quest, unbeknownst to me. It was just a curiosity I had. So I was always looking out for it in what I read and who I talked to. Ultimately, it came down to when anyone was asked, or if I was in a discussion with someone and I asked them, hey, how did you get to where you've gotten? Like, what made you become as good as you've become? I started to figure out that there were certain words that were in every single answer, no matter what. Now, it wouldn't be that this word is in all 7,000 people I came in contact with over my life. No, but they came up so consistently, I started to think, wow, there must be something to this. And it gets back to what you said originally. Words become the most powerful when we define them and live them. That's when they become powerful. Not just to have them in your vocabulary. Like, that's the difference. Some people have these words in their vocabulary that are in the book, but other people live these words. So over the 35 years that I was kind of just both intentionally and unintentionally studying this, I found out that there were really four. There's 25 total. I first started out with a list of 93. And I thought, wow, if I'm going to put a book together, I can't put 93. I'll get bored with reading it, right? So I kind of whittled it down because some were pretty similar. And I got it down to 25. And then of the 25, the more I went back and looked at my notes and the conversations I had, et cetera, my research, I guess you'd say, there were four that came out most frequently. And there's one that I believe is the single most important word in all of success, no matter what we do. No matter what any of your listeners are doing, whatever industry they're in, craft they're working on, the single most important word in all of success is the word truth. Truth. And the reason I say that is because how can we get to where we want to go without knowing the truth about what we're doing well? Let's keep doing that and try and enhance that. And more importantly, what I found from the best of the best is they appreciate when you tell them they did something well, but they really want to know what they're not doing well. That can take them up that little bit, that 1% that we keep reading about in the books, right? Making them a little bit better. So for me, truth was the single most important word in all of success because it allowed me to know where I stood, right? Now, it's important when we haven't gotten into truth tellers and all that sort of stuff, right? And who's around you and who's in your circles and all that, right? So, and in no particular order, and really the acronym for this is TIPS, T-I-P-S. These are the four with the T, truth, being number one. The other three are the word intentional. And for me, as I said, I define these, right? And intentional is what we do on purpose to fulfill our purpose. What are we doing on purpose each and every day to fulfill our purpose as a coach, as a manager, as a director of a department, as a sociology professor? What are we doing on purpose to make sure we fulfill that purpose to the best of our ability? So that's intentional. Preparation was another word that came up all the time, and we just spoke about that. Its definition in my illogical mind, I guess, is be there before you get there. And then the last word that came up most often was the word standards. And we simply defined it as what you are willing to live up to or what you are willing to intentionally dip down to. And we put that word intentionally in there because we want to know it's your choice. You're dipping down to those low standards, right? So those are the four that, and when you speak of teams, my goodness, teams in sports or teams in the corporate world, they've got to have those four things present, available, and living those things each and every day to become their best.
So Kevin, building on that a little bit, I mean, words are sometimes in response to questions, and you talk about the power of great questions. I mean, I'll let you give a scorecard to Paul and I afterwards around how our questions are today, but could you just say something about, you know, what are the challenging questions that great teams ask themselves?
Well, first off, that's a good question. And what immediately came to front of mind, not just to mind, but immediately to the front, was what am I willing to sacrifice? What am I willing to sacrifice for this group? Because what we define team as when you're working with one or more people. So what am I willing to sacrifice? Because all of us can't do everything we want to do every minute of every game of every year. But we look at sacrifice in two ways. There's the ways that winning teams look at sacrifice. And I believe there's a difference in the way the winner looks at sacrifice, this word. And there's a difference. You know, there's some teams out there that do a lot of winning, but they're never the winner. And in pro sports in particular, especially in the NBA, I mean, you get into that as a coach and a player, ultimately to win something that you can't buy. Right. Even though they make all that money, they can't buy the world championship ring that we got in 2008 with the Celtics. Right. So it comes down to question number one would be, what are you willing to sacrifice? And if we ask the common person on the street define sacrifice for us, they would probably say something to the effect of, it's something I give up. And it truly is. You do have to give up something for the betterment of the team. But to take that a step further to what we found the best of the best teams, the ones that really are competing for becoming the best and ultimately become the best, it's not something you just give up. It's also something you do for. It's not just what you give up. It's what you do for a teammate. So maybe we had a player by the name of Ray Allen, who was a great shooter, one of the best shooters ever to play basketball over here in the States. And maybe he's going up into his shot and coming at him is a 7-footer with a long wingspan, but Ray still can probably take that shot and make it. But again, on our Celtics teams, he saw in the corner another really good player by the name of Paul Pierce open in the corner for an even easier shot. So he passes the ball to Paul. If Ray were on this call, he would say, that's not a shot I gave up. It's something I did for the team. Because that was a little bit better than my shot that I could have taken. Even though I might have been able to make it, I knew Paul had a higher percentage of probably making his shot. So what do you sacrifice? The other two that we always asked is, all right, guys, let's sit down here and let's talk this thing out. What defines a winning team? What is it? It could be words. It could be a sentence. Just what is it? Right. And we wanted them to tell us and each other what that looked like. Right. And then when they said whatever it was, it could be unselfishness. It could be concentration and practice. It could whatever those 7 to 10 things were. We then went back with each and every one of them and we said, OK, are you willing to be held accountable for this one? And most of the times they answered yes to every one of them. So, okay, we got that out of the way. They've now given us permission. They may not like it. I'm not saying that. But they've given us permission to hold them accountable. And then the other one we asked the teams, our teams, was what defines a losing team? And many times it'll be the opposite of what they just said defines a winning team. But we still wanted to talk that out. So I would say those would be three questions, with the sacrifice one being the most important. And that one in particular would go to our best players, right? Like when we won the championship in 2008, we had three Hall of Fame players on our team: Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and Paul Pierce. And the first meeting that Doc Rivers had with all three of them in the same room together, that was the first question he asked: what are each of you willing to sacrifice? And then we explained it's not just something you give up, it's also something you do for the team. So those would probably be the questions that we would ask.
So Kevin, building on that in your time at the Celtics, I mean, another team principle or a team principle you had there was that it's more important to get it right than for you to be right. I just wondered if you could speak a little bit to what that principle means, and also how you implement that in practice.
Well, make sure I get back to implement in practice. But really, again, these are discussions we had with our team. You know, you can lead by guessing and hoping, or you can lead by finding out what really is the truth. We chose to do that. And we chose the way we chose to do that was just to sit in a room face to face, not finger to finger, click to click, but face to face, eye to eye, and let's talk this thing out. Guys, what if we want to win a championship, do we have to do the right things or the wrong things on the court? They'll all say the right things. Okay, so is it important that we get the most important right thing to do done, right? They'll all say yes, right? So we say, okay, will there be times when there's going to be some conflicting thoughts on what the right thing is to do? They're going to say yes, right? So we said, okay, then this is what we really need to talk about. If we all agree that this is the right thing, we're all going to do that. But in those instances where there might be two or three guys that really believe in what they think is the right thing to do, let's talk that out. And then we also talk about the hierarchy of leadership. We wanted our teams to be involved in the decision, but at some point, a person has to make the decision. In our case, it was the head coach. And we would ask our guys, are you in agreement with that? Like at some point, someone has to make the decision. They all said yes, right? So it got down to what we're talking about now. We all can't be right all the time, right? And we have to be okay with maybe it's not our suggestion that gets utilized, right? We want your input, but it may not always be your suggestion. And backtracking now, keep in mind, anyone that came into the organization, they knew what our culture was about. And one of the foundational pillars of our culture was truth. You were going to hear the truth and you were going to accept the truth from someone else. So along those lines, that meant that even though Kevin Eastman gave what he thought was the best thing for us to do, ultimately we decided on something that Eric suggested. Because the more we talked it out, that really, for where we were right then and there, that was the right thing to do, right? So for us, that was kind of one of the things that we did. We also had a right-wrong test, as silly as this is. And we figured out maybe 10 to 12 things. Okay, coming late to practice every day. Guys, right or wrong? Well, wrong. Not competing very hard in the game, right or wrong. And we kept on going down, right? So at the end of that particular session, it was, okay, this is what you told us is the right way to do things. And that's maybe going to be our filter with which we make these decisions going forward, right? So because what happens, and you guys have seen it because you've been in or studied sport probably or watched it for sure, your best players are usually also have one of the ingredients they have, personality ingredients, is stubbornness. Because the way they've done it has gotten them to that level at that point in their career. So so for us, we just, look, ultimately, we have to make the decision. And you don't always have to be right. But as a team, we need to get this right. And then we have to work hard. Here's the other problem with that, Eric, is that maybe the person or people who didn't get the something done the way they wanted to, maybe they try and subtly sabotage that decision. No. The other thing we talked about was we have to make it work while we're seeing if it works. Because everyone who's listening to this today, even in the highest level of leadership, maybe positions that are on this call, any change you make, any big decision you make, and I hate to say this, but I kind of believe it. It's a researched, educated guess. We don't know. So what we have to do is we have to make it work while we're seeing and evaluating if it works. So, and what was the other one?
Just in terms of, you know, implementing this idea, which you're speaking to, but just the kind of, when you turn that principle into action, where do the stresses lie from your experience?
Well, I guess the stresses would lie in high pressure situations when quite possibly what we decided to do didn't work, right? Well, because we try and make as many decisions as we can and talk about things as much as we can as a team, as a unit, as a group, as an organization, before we get into that emotional moment. Because we try and make some of these decisions ahead of time logically when emotions don't play a part, right? So we would have probably, well, not would have, we discussed that as well as a staff. Look, if something doesn't go right in a game and maybe Eric said we should do this, right? But Paul said we should do this. And we kind of went with Paul's decision because it seemed the most right at the time, but it's not working, right? Maybe in a huddle at a timeout, we might say, hey guys, look, we're going to make an adjustment here. And this is what we're going to do now. Right now, after the game, if Eric, you want to come in and say, hey, that was my idea, great. We'll pat you on the back and say, great. Right. So, but again, I think all of the preparation, all of the conversations, all of the communication prior to the season starting, and constant reminders throughout the season about things like this help you get through these things when they're actually happening, if that makes sense.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of the things I find fascinating reading about the NBA, Kevin, is the players are so transient that, you know, they move so often. And this must be difficult when you're trying to establish a team culture. I'm wondering, over your journey, what have you found have been the most effective ways for people to integrate themselves when they step into a new culture?
Well, I think it starts as you evaluate that particular person you're wanting to join your program. We wanted people that in our research, we found out that they thrived and could produce at the level we needed production out of them in a culture like ours, right? So that's number one, trying to do the best job you can to try and get culture fits. And really that came down to values fits, right? We wanted to bring in people, whether it be in the ticket office, whether it be in the front office that does the scouting, or whether it be a player. We wanted to bring like values people, but not necessarily like thinkers, right? We wanted diversity of thought, but we wanted like values. For instance, you know, integrity was one of ours. So we didn't want to bring in someone who's gotten to where they've gotten because he's a notorious or she's a notorious cheater, right? It wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't work. So we do the research ahead of time. Is this person a fit in our culture? And then one of the things that we often say is this to any player coming in. Look, we traded for you because we think you can help us get to where we want to go. But you have to understand we have a culture here. So you have to become us. We don't become you, right? You have to integrate into how we do things, right? We don't do everything. Well, yeah, coach, I love your culture, except, you know, I only practice one day a week and I only go 15 hard minutes during that practice. I just want you to know that ahead of time. No. We don't become you. No, that ain't going to work here, right? So that's the next thing. The next thing is to have a culture clarity conversation. Being very clear on day one, before they even one bead of sweat goes out of their forehead onto their practice uniform. Guy, Paul, this is our culture, right? And usually it'll be one of the assistant coaches kind of maybe breaking that down for a player and letting them ask any questions about it. And, you know, if it were me talking to the player, I'd probably remind them periodically through the first few weeks, maybe month and a half, just about culture. Right. Hey, see that? See what Eric did? That's he verbalized our culture right there. Now, nobody would know that outside of our team, but that's our culture. See what he did when that guy went on the floor and he ran over and helped him up? That's our culture. Because anytime a person can see and feel the culture rather than just hear it, it's got a better chance, we think, of number one, being understood and hopefully being internalized. So the clarity conversation, and people have different definitions of clarity. You know, the one I hear the most is just making sure that people understand what you mean. Nah, that ain't working in today's world. We didn't want to get them to just understand. We wanted to get them to the point where what we said was so clear that it was impossible to misunderstand what we were saying. That's what clarity meant to us. And we would break it down. You know, our basic culture dealt around this concept that, and you may want to talk about it later, we may want to or not, an African way of life called Mbutu. That was a big part of our championship culture, right? That we hadn't known about prior to Doc running into actually a professor on Marquette University's campus one summer. So, but in case you want to get to that later, I'll stop there.
Just on the values piece, Kevin, I think what supports that story or what underpins that story is the story of how you joined the Celtics and how you got there through a meeting with Doc's son, Jeremiah. Could you talk a little bit about that, the events that led up to that meeting, and then how Doc approached you to join?
My goodness, you guys have done your research. I forgot about that. I should have had you guys. I should have had you guys talk to me and ask me questions before I wrote the book. I would have remembered more stuff about my life. But and you guys have probably had that experience too. All of a sudden, someone says something to you, and you're like, "Dang, I haven't thought of that in like 20 years. How do they know that? And I forgot it." Anyway. So it goes with one of my life's philosophies. And at that time, I was in obviously the world of basketball. Now I'm in the world of speaking. But one of my philosophies when I was in the world of basketball went like this: never pass up a basketball opportunity. So I'm going to try and fast break this story. I'll probably have to leave a lot of it. But in essence, when I left the NBA for a year, then I got back into it, but I left it for about a year. I went to work for Nike. And one of the things they had me do, because I was one of the better skill development coaches in the country over here, they had me go around the country and work out with a whole bunch of players. Well, they're key players, the guys they eventually wanted them to wear the shoe, the Nike brand, when they got to be a pro. So they also would send me to the AAU teams, the summer basketball teams that these elite players played on. So one of my assignments was to go down to Orlando, Florida and work out this team. Well, they only ever give me the best players' names. And I'm not going to give last name, but the best player on this team was Keith. So they wanted me to start to develop a relationship with Keith, but work out the entire team. So I'd work out the entire team. And the way I would work out is, you know, I'd be on the floor with them pushing, grinding, holding, right, fouling, sweating, right? Because one thing I found out when you're skill development coaches, players love coaches who sweat with them. They love coaches who sweat with them, who get in there and do it with them, right? So I go ahead and do that. After about 2 hours, we're done. I go on, I get on the plane the next morning, I fly out. Well, never am I asked to come back a second time, right? So about 10 days later, Nike says, hey, we want you to go back to Orlando and work out that same team again. So I said, okay, I'm good with that. So I was saying to myself, man, they must really think this Keith guy is good, right? Because the first time I had to go back a second time. So I go in, as I walk into the gym, the high school coach of the gym we were using, he says, Kevin, are you okay if we film this? And my mind immediately went, he probably wants to use it for his team. So I said, yeah, coach, I'm good with that. If you want to film it and use it with your team, yeah, go ahead, whatever you need to do. So we go through the next one. Well, one of the players on the team, after the first workout, went home and told his father, you know, just an AAU parent, right? Summer basketball coach's parent. Hey, dad, like this guy we had was really good. He sweated with us. He knew the game. He knew how to teach. We could relate to him, all these positive things. And that, you know, the parent was like, oh, well, good. I'm glad that Nike does that for you guys. Well, the second time I go back, same thing goes again. Well, I come to find out the parent that this kid went home to tell the dad about me, that parent's name was Doc Rivers, who was on the verge of getting the Boston Celtics head coaching job, right? So the reason I had to go back, Doc asked the high school coach, who was a friend, to record the workout. And I think he did it because he wanted to see if his eyes saw what Jeremiah's eyes saw, right? Because, you know, kids are, he's thinking, nah, I know Jeremiah, he can't evaluate a coach, right? So anyway, had I said no to the opportunity when Nike asked me to do the workouts, I wouldn't be talking to you today, right? So, and then obviously the other lesson there is do the best you can at where you are that day. And eventually, I believe if you're supposed to get somewhere, the success gods will take care of you. If you take care of yourself and you take care of the people that you've been asked to work with. So that's how that story went.
There's a great line in the book. It's a small line towards the end where you say there's always a shortlist, even if you don't know there is a shortlist. And I circled it and I thought, what a great example of a mindset to take to work every day. And I think that story you just shared is a great illustration of that in action.
Yeah. And the other thing there is you never know who's watching. You never know who's listening. You just never know. And then the other thing I think is just the lesson of the word pride. Hey, do your best that particular time where you are. Right. Have pride in your work. And then if someone, you know, if someone sees it, that can eventually jumpstart your career, you know, more power to that experience.
So, Kevin, maybe let's just loop back to Ubuntu, because you talked a bit about that. Can you just say a little bit about the meaning behind that philosophy and how it builds or built connection in the Celtics?
Yeah, you know, connection's a huge word right now, not only in all the leadership and team books, but just within teams themselves, especially, and I'm sure all across the world. But you see, like, today is the evening of the college national football championship game. And when you read about both programs, the University of Washington and the University of Michigan, inevitably, the article will point to their team is so connected, right? So where Ubuntu helped us was it had two basic foundational pillars or two basic tenets that really fed this concept of team. And the two tenets are people are people because of other people. People are people because of other people. And the second tenet is I can only be all I can be if you are all you can be. So let's look at the first one. People are people because of other people. Over here in the NBA, the Professional Basketball League, everyone knows the name LeBron James. Well, the first year LeBron went to the Los Angeles Lakers, not quite so good. Then they traded to get this guy by the name of Anthony Davis, who's a very good, very, very, very good basketball player, right? 6'11", 7-footer, highly skilled. And they added some other pieces around LeBron. They won the championship, right? LeBron needs more than just LeBron to win championships, right? So that's where it's people are people because of other people. LeBron is at his best when others do their job and help him, put him into positions where he can do his best job too. So that's tenet number one. The second one is I can only be all I can be if you are all you can be. I'm trying to think of it. Well, maybe you won't know the names, but with the championship Boston Celtic team, we had the player I was talking about, Ray Allen. He's in the Hall of Fame right now, the Basketball Hall of Fame here. He was the great shooter. We also had a player on that team by the name of Rajon Rondo. He was a point guard. He was a great passer, not good, great. Well, they needed each other because Rajon wanted to lead the NBA in assists. Ray wanted to lead the NBA in three-point field goal percentage. So when Rajon's coming down the floor and penetrating into the lane, and he says sees Ray wide open in the corner, and he throws him a pass, the first thing is he has to give him a great pass. Because if he gives him a pass down by his ankles, it's going to take too long for Ray to get it to here, his shooting pocket, and then eventually take the shot. Chances are the shot doesn't go in. So Ray needed Rajon to throw a great pass. And great shooters will tell you they want the pass between their chest and their shoulder, because then they can go right up into their shot. They don't want it down below their waist, because that's going to take a second to get it to the shooting pocket, right? So Ray needed Rajon to throw a great pass. Well, Rajon needed Ray to make the shot in order to get the assist. So that's a prime example right there of I can only be all I can be, the three-point percentage leader of the NBA, if you are what you can be, Rajon being a great passer. So that is the foundation of Mbutu. And where it creates connection is Mbutu is all about caring for someone else. And think about all of our lives. Who are we most connected to? The people who probably have a care and concern for us, right? It's our wives, it's our children, whatever it is, it's our best friends. We know they care about us. And that's the glue that is Mbutu, that keeps Mbutu together. And the other thing it does, the other thing about this word connection is we found, especially in a leadership position, you can create connections by sharing your story, right? Because the ultimate form of leadership is to get to get a piece of the mind, or the ultimate goal, get a piece of the mind of the people you are leading. When they're at work, making sure their mind is on their work, right? How do you get a piece of the mind? Because leadership is about two spaces, mind space, M-I-N-D, we believe, and heart space. And the reason I say heart space is in order to get to the mind, we try to travel through the heart, building the relationships, sharing our stories, right? Helping our people, right? And then the other part of this connection thing is going through adversity we found help us become a little bit more connected, because we had to go through something hard, something difficult, something where we all had to pitch in, right? Where we all had to really not only know our roles, but execute our roles to the nth degree in order to get our way out of this hole or this adversity. So those would be some of the ways, I think, to answer that question.
Building on what you were touching on there, Kevin, you know, you've got this philosophy of oneness and being for others. You know, at the same time, you're in a competitive environment, you're driving championships. How do you deal with internal competition? I mean, Oh, how do okay. you deal with the, yeah,
My
the
fault.
Fact that, that people have got, they're competitive by nature and they're put into a competitive situation. How do you deal with that? That must come up all the time. How do you reconcile that and work with that in the context of your team philosophy?
Well, again, you start before you actually start. You have that conversation about competition. And first we define competition because there's fake competitors. In our sport, the guy who dives after a loose ball on the floor and has no chance of getting it, but it looks good, and the coach will say, wow, he's really playing hard. No, he's playing stupid, right? The ball's out of bounds, right? How about playing hard when three guys dive after the ball, then dive after it? That's a competitor, right? So competition is defined by us as you are still playing hard and giving your best effort even when you are playing horribly. Meaning maybe your shot's not going in and you're turning the ball over, but you're still playing hard. And the other part of the definition of competition is you're still playing hard and giving your best effort even when you're down by 33 points. Because that's when you can tell the true competitor, when you're being soundly beaten or when your game is so bad that particular night. What do? Do you give in? Right? No, so a competitor doesn't give in. So that's number one. Number two, we talk about, hey, look, guys, only five players can start each game. And we've done this exercise before. We have asked all of our players to write down the number of minutes they think they should play per game. Our game is, let's look at the college game. The college game is 40 minutes long. So there's five players on the floor at one time. So five times 40 means there's 200 minutes available in every game for your team. Well, when we add up all those minutes that our players say they should be playing, it comes out to like 331. So we tell our guys, okay, look, there's a 131 minutes. How do we do this? Guys, everybody can't play as much as they want to play. And you have to trust us as a coach. We're going to put the players in there that should be in there at that particular time of the game, right? And that'll be based on what we see in practice, what we see when you get minutes in a game. You know, we have this term over here. I don't know if you do garbage time, the end of a game when maybe the game's already decided. You know, you might be winning by 30 or being losing by 30, and you put maybe the end of your bench in. We educate our guys, that's not garbage time. That's proving time. Proving time. Play great through those 20 minutes, even though we're down 30. Show us that you are playing the way we need you to play, right? So, look, in a competitive sport, some guys play, some guys don't. And you just got to kind of talk it out. But we talk ahead of time that this is going to happen to you guys. We don't know who just yet, because maybe over the course of a year, we might have nine different starting lineups, right? And you guys have a term. Do you have a term over there called next man up? You know, somebody gets injured, next man up.
Yeah.
We don't believe in that term. Anybody can be next man up. We want next man prepared. Next man prepared. So even though they're not playing, we're spending high quality time with them before practice, after practice, to try and get their skills up, their level of understanding of how we want to play up so they can get more minutes, right? So competition is just a fact of life when you're in a sport. And we don't want the competition, we want to compete in practice and push people in practice, because the starter, if he's being pushed by the second unit guy a little bit harder than maybe some other teams we're competing against, that's going to make our starter better too, right? So, you know, it's a difficult thing. And what we simply do is we try and talk our guys through it and what we're thinking and why we're thinking that. Because the question everybody asks who's not playing, they all ask the coach this question: how can I get more minutes? How can I play more? And you have to have the answer for that. And that answer is different for different players. Right. So it's, again, we're not going to rely on hoping, guessing. We're just going to sit down with our guys, explain it to them as best we can, and they may still leave that meeting, that conversation, pissed off. But at least you put it out there. This is why you are where you are. So, and they know our intent is to, like, if you're going to play, there's what they call YMCA basketball over here, youth basketball. That's where everybody plays. Have a good time. Everybody plays kumbaya. Well, as you climb that ladder, only the players who should be on the floor are on the floor. It's competitive. So you got to be able to deal with that. And then when you get your minutes, you got to be able to be productive in those minutes. But we'll prepare you just like we prepare the starters. We'll prepare you for those minutes. We'll keep you in shape. We'll make sure you know the game plan, all the things that go into being a productive player on the floor. We're going to do that for you. So that's kind of how we deal with it. It's not easy, though. And that means Kevin, you have to have hard conversations, right?
Yeah.
You have to have some hard conversations.
So, Kevin, taking a leader's perspective then for a point on this, I mean, you've said that great leaders can see the invisible. Can you say a little bit around what are the things that they see?
Yeah, I think they see the invisible and hear the inaudible, right? We had a saying around our programs called, I know what he said, but what did he say? I know what he said, but what did he say? Right? And that might be, I can think of an example. We had this real kind of hockey rookie that played for us. I'm not going to name the name. And we had this guy by the name of Kevin Garnett, who's like one of the best players ever to play the game of basketball. He's in the Hall of Fame now. So after the game, the cocky rookie was asked, what did you think of Kevin's performance? And the answer was, he played well. You know, he gets a lot of our shots and Doc gives him a green light and, you know, he can make some mistakes and still stay in the game, but he played well. That's what he said. What he really said was this: if I got all those shots, if Doc would just play me more minutes, if he wouldn't take me out when I make mistakes, I could do the same thing Kevin Garnett could do. So that's why I always monitored newspaper articles. I monitored them. Doc never read them because he didn't want to know what people were saying. He wanted to keep a clear mind. I wanted to read them because I wanted to know who I needed to talk to. So I had to interpret sometimes, okay, that's what he said, but I think this is what he really said. What did I do? Face to face. Why guess? Leadership by guessing doesn't work. And I haven't seen a book on that. Maybe one of you guys should write a book on leadership by guessing. A leadership by hoping, leadership by wishing. It doesn't work. Leadership by conversation, right? Leadership by relationships, leadership by truth. At least it gives you a chance to know what might truly be going on with that player with your team. So, you know who was one of the most important guys in our organization with the Los Angeles Clippers? Was our equipment manager. Our equipment manager, the guy who does the wash. How could he be that important? Because he was one of the best relationship people in our organization. Guys would talk to him. We could find out some things that were going on through this equipment manager. A lot of people didn't see that. Why? Because a lot of people look and then they judge. Where is that person on the hierarchy? What is their title? How much power do they have? Rather than not about titles, offices, power, it's about impact, influence, inspiration. The three I's, I think, of great leaders. Great leaders impact people. They inspire people, right? And obviously they have to influence as well. But in the books, we only hear about influence. Those other two eyes are really important too. So I saw this in this guy. I knew how, like, and then he would come up and give us some suggestions when I was in the front office. I left the bench and went into the kind of the business side of the organization for a while. And he would have some great suggestions. And as I really concentrated on who was coming in, you know, nobody saw this. They just saw him as a guy who cleaned the shorts. Right. So I saw the invisible. And, you know, the best leaders have to go through their leadership day with big eyes, big ears, and a small mouth. Big eyes, big ears, and a small mouth. Look around, observe what's going on. Listen, right? You may be in the coffee room and there's a conversation going on where you might hear some stuff you need to hear because they may not even know that you're there, right? So I always had my ears wide open, my eyes wide open, and I tried to keep this shut except when I needed to utilize it, right? So enough on that.
Kevin, you've been very generous with your time. I just perhaps just one last question if we could.
Yep.
And it's the legacy question. So you've had a great career. You've done college. You've done youth teams. You've been up to the NBA. You've spoken all over the world, and you've interacted with so many people. As you reflect back on this legacy of the people you've interacted with, the people you've led, how do you hope that they describe it?
Well, I know this about legacy. If that's your focal point each and every day, I'm not sure you actually have one. I think it's how you live and the example you set. That's your legacy. But I guess I would say, if they had to say anything, it would be care for, was there for, and impacted me in a positive way. Cared for us, was there for us, and impacted me or us in a positive way. And you never know, you know, a legacy is built drip by slow drip by slow drip. A legacy is built by one conversation at a time, not this huge deluge of things that happen. And then I think, you know, the other thing about legacy, and I said it in the book, and you can flip it either way you want. I'll let the listener figure out which comes first, which comes second. But, you know, do your part in your piece of the world. A legacy doesn't have to be something that is left so that in all the history books, your name is in there. There are some incredible legacies that have been left where no one will ever know about it. It could be a legacy in a family. It could be a legacy in a neighborhood. It could be a legacy in a certain part and portion of the world that really needs some help and some care and some time, right? So I think lead a good life, do the right thing, and you'll have your best shot at leaving a legacy.
I think that's a great place for us to finish. Kevin, I wanted to thank you for your time. I know that you've got a college football game to watch tonight, so we appreciate you squeezing us in. And we look forward to sharing some of these great ideas you've got around leadership, self-leadership, and teams with a wider audience.
Well, Paul and Eric, thanks for having me on, first off. And one day, if ever I get back over there, our paths will cross face-to-face.
Look forward to it.
Okay, get your coffee now.
Thanks, Kevin. Have a good one.
See you guys.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Eric, not a bad interview. Some great stories there. What were some of the things that stood out for you?
Yeah, look, I love this concept around how you join a team and how you join a philosophy that's as strong as what the Celtics have with Ubuntu. Because, you know, on the one hand, you hear a lot of nicety and friendliness and you know, open-mindedness between the teammates. But if you're not in with how they do business, there isn't a place for you, right? So I think that, you know, those tough conversations are really tough. And I thought that Kevin touched on that, but I could see some pain there beneath the surface, because I do think that it falls to the leaders, the head coach, the captain, to sort of be able to articulate that culture, that set of values, and keep people in line there. What about you, Paul?
He reminded me so much of Paul Roos, the Australian rules football coach. In that he's focused on truth and uncovering it and nurturing it and encouraging it. It was just, it came through so many times in the interview. And I know that we hear a lot about difficult conversations and the importance of having them, but gee, they're difficult for a reason, right? And they're very hard to open up, and they're very hard to do on an ongoing nature. It's much easier just to walk past them sometimes. But so his ideas around truth really connected with me.
Yeah, and building on that a little bit, I mean, I'm really struck by this idea that he said, which is in some ways how the story started for him with the Celtics, which is that he sweated with us. I think players have this deep appreciation when you take the issue of truth, where the coach has stood in their shoes. He's one of them, you know, because I think, you know, especially in sport, but I think in so many other organizations, a lot of the kind of motivation, the purpose comes from people's internal identity. And if players can identify with leaders, I think it makes such a big difference, because the trust, the respect, the you know, willingness to go along with something when they're not quite sure is so much greater when people think, well, you know, this leader sweated with us. They're in our shoes, but they're one of us. I think that's a very powerful statement.
I couldn't agree more. And the way I often think about that is, you know, in the weekend paper, there's often a business lift out. I read it after I've read the sport and the culture section. But what I always find interesting is when a new leader is announced in a business and they have a photo of usually them standing by a desk or standing prominently in an office. And it always, and there was one on the weekend that I pointed out to my wife, it always strikes me as an interesting choice, because if you're working with a business that's got lots of moving parts and there's, you know, there's a large operational focus for that business, you know, I would have thought you would want your first impression to be, you know, I'm not focused on this office. I'm focused on the reality of the day-to-day grind, where the sweat happens. I don't know whether I'm being terribly naive, but.
Look, you know, another way of saying that, which is, I mean, I'm really, you know, I love his focus on words and words matter. But another way of thinking about that is the text and the subtext, right? So the text is the thing you read in the paper, what the person says. The subtext is the impression that you, Paul, have made from watching that picture, you know, what you actually think when you read that. And I think so much of leadership is in the subtext and not in the text. You know, journalists might write one way of telling the story, but what the people who do the work, what do they actually think? You know, how are they interpreting that? I think is really powerful. And that's what I took away when you know, you made the comment and drawing on his comments that, you know, there's always a shortlist. You never know who's watching, and to have pride in your work, be the best you can where you are today, I think goes to, you know, all the invisible, the inaudibles, the subtext, the things that, you know, you think get missed but actually make a world of difference in the end, because it's through those small interactions that big things come, like going off and coaching the Celtics.
Well, he actually, yeah, it was a great story he shared of coaching the Celtics. But I think he summed up that idea well when he said, see the invisible and hear the inaudible. It was probably the second part of that that my ears really pricked up, this idea of hearing the inaudible. And, of course, he gave the Ted Lasso example of the person that washes the shorts being the person that's got all the information. Of course, anyone who's watched Ted Lasso will know what I mean by that. But I thought it was very, very profound and a very, very interesting observation.
Well, I think it's the same point about what you said with leaders, right? Leaders hear when they subvert hierarchy and authority and go to the front line. And when they see where the work is done and the people who are doing that work and how they think and how they feel and how they react, they're seeing things that would be invisible or audible to them if they spent their whole life in the boardroom only, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's only so much that you can glean from a boardroom. It's important, but it's not everything.
No, it's not at all. Eric, is there anything else that jumped out at you before we wrap it up? I mean, the idea of sacrifice comes through quite strongly. And then I love this idea of sacrifice being linked to the idea you can win something that you can't buy.
Yeah. Yeah, look, it's an interesting way of putting it, isn't it? it certainly got me thinking. I was thinking about what am I sacrificing here and there. It put me on the spot, I have to say, Paul. I have to rewrite my New Year's resolutions.
Well, we'll look forward to talking to you about your New Year's resolutions later on. Of course, you and I are catching up in a couple of short hours to talk about the year ahead with the podcast. But Eric, thank you very much for your time today, as always. Look forward to chatting with you again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Paul. Speak soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.